This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, actor Bobby Cannavale, is starring on Broadway with Al Pacino in a revival of David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross. Even if you don't recognize his name, you've probably seen him in a number of film and TV roles. He was the violent gangster Gyp Rossetti in the most recent season of the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Here's a scene in which he's speaking to the residents of a small New Jersey town his crew has taken over to run a bootlegging operation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First things out the way, thank you for coming. Those of you who were curious, and those who were maybe escorted here. My name is Mr. Rossetti. My associates and me have taken an interest in your town and are going to be here for a while, so we thought it only neighborly to introduce ourselves. In return for your hospitality and any inconveniences may cause, we're offering a monthly give back. Tell them how much we're offering.
A double C apiece.
In English.
$200 a month.
Which is a pretty square deal for keeping your mouth shut, wouldn't you say, Sheriff Ramsey? He's a good man, your sheriff. And he's gonna keep on sheriffing. Same as you all are gonna keep doing whatever it is you do. Barbers cut hair, cooks cook, librarians keep checking out books because it's very important to read.
What happens when Bible camp opens?
Bible camp's canceled. And I'm not really doing questions and answers right now, dear.
You might have also seen Bobby Cannavale as the chatty guy running a coffee stand in the 2003 film The Station Agent, or as a tough hospital administrator in the most recent season of the Showtime series Nurse Jackie, or as Will's boyfriend on the NBC series Will and Grace, for which he won an Emmy Award. Cannavale's done plenty of theater, too. He earned a Tony Award nomination for his role in a play with Chris Rock, whose title can't be said on the radio. It's something like The Mother with the Hat. He recently spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Bobby Cannavale, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Dave.
You're appearing on Broadway in Glengarry Glen Ross with Al Pacino, playing the role that he played in the film version, the hotshot real estate salesman Ricky Roma.
And correct, yeah.
Is it true that this had something to do with you sitting next to Al Pacino at the Tony Awards for a different performance?
Yeah. Two Tonys ago, it's about a year and a half ago now, I was fortunate enough to be nominated for the Best Actor category, and so was Al, who I wouldn't have called Al 4 months ago, but now I can call him Al. And I'd never met him before, and he's my favorite actor, and I'd always wanted to meet him, and I'd always wanted him to come to see a show, and I always, it was kind of like a little thing I'd say in my head, Pacino's coming tonight, whenever I do a play. And so they sat me next to him, and I just leaned over to him, and I introduced myself, and he said, I know who you are. And I said, I would love it if you could come see our show. And he said, I'm coming. And he came on the last show and stayed in my dressing room for, over an hour, just talking to me. It was amazing. And when he left, he said, we're going to do it. And then I got a phone call about 3 months later asking me if I'd be interested in reading and taking a look at Glengarry with Al playing the machine and myself playing Richard Roma, yeah.
When he said, we're going to do it, do you know what he meant? Did you know what he meant?
No. No, but I just said yes anyway.
whatever it is. Now, Glengarry Glen Ross, of course, is the David Mamet play about real estate salesmen in Chicago, desperately competing for sales. Tell us a little about building the Ricky Roma character that you played.
Well, it's one of those plays that actors talk about and say it's a perfect play. And it's a perfect play because it's about, seven guys who desperately want something and need something in a time where people desperately want and need things. It was written, 1982. I think it's a prescient play to do today. But let's face it, I think the great plays are about people wanting things and desperate for things. I think it's what makes great drama. And I think that's one of those things that's just always resonant. It's just what we are as a culture and in America in particular. So he sets it in a very specific place. As you said, the small real estate office, a little shabby real estate office in Chicago, in the world of sales and in the world before the internet, by the way, where something like cold calling, which Al's character, Shelley, describes as, walking up to the door. I don't even know their name. I'm selling them something they don't even want. So it was a skill to sell something and put on a front and acting in a sense. And so it makes the play very active. For Ricky, you know, he's on top and desperate to stay on top.
I mean, there are a lot of really intense exchanges here, some profane, you know, angry arguments that occur. And I wondered, since you do this, you know, night after night with the same crew, if the energy is sometimes different. You get something different from an actor, and it feels different, and you respond differently.
Oh, sure. You know, I think that is what makes it the living, breathing thing it is. And, you know, we joke about it sometimes. You know, like we'll get together at the curtain call. We all come out, curtain's down, and there's the quick four-word review from everybody, you know. Not bad. Last night, Johnny C. actually said, solid B, guys. And, you know, like it happens. Maybe somebody's not as desperate, let's say. It throws it off, but not necessarily in negative ways. You know, it just means that maybe one guy gets eaten a little easier than he did the night before. But we're definitely there to devour each other. It's just, sure, it's different levels. I guess, you know, people bring different things in with them. I know yesterday I was late because the train took forever. And I was rushing the whole time and went out not quite prepared. And something else happened. But it's ethereal. I can't really describe it. We talk about it, you know, actors talk about it in the theater in terms of degrees. You know, when you have a bad show, if you've been working the show and you've rehearsed the show, we're talking about degrees that the right. audience won't notice, but you sure feel it. Those are the nights you opt to walk home rather than get in the car.
Right.
Think about it for a couple hours.
We're speaking with Bobby Cannavale. He appeared in the recent season of HBO's Boardwalk Empire. He's now appearing on Broadway with Al Pacino in the David Mamet play Glengarry Glen Ross. You have an interesting background. You grew up North Jersey, right?
I grew up right across the river here in Union City, New Jersey, which is next to Hoboken as a reference. So right across the Lincoln Tunnel.
And your dad was Italian-American, your mom Cuban-American, right? And they split when you were pretty young. And
my mom's Cuban, born in Cuba, yeah.
And then you lived in Puerto Rico for a time and then Florida, is that right?
Yeah, I grew up in New Jersey and then lived for 2 years in Puerto Rico when my mom remarried. And we lived in Puerto Rico for 2 years when I was about six, seven. Then came back to New Jersey and then moved to Florida my freshman year of high school. And then I came back to New Jersey my senior year of high school and moved into the city a couple years later.
Were you always a performer as a kid, a cut-up?
100%. Yeah, I was that kid that everybody like always said, he's so creative, because I was always play-acting and had a very vivid imagination. And I started reading at a very young age. I was obsessed with reading, and I started reading plays at a really young age. I just was drawn to them. There was a great library in my neighborhood on 15th Street in Union City, and they had an arts section that wasn't very big, and what they had was the yearbook every year, the theater directory yearbook, the best plays of, and it went as far back as like the 1930s. That's how I remember reading A Streetcar Named Desire and reading all those plays, Death of a Salesman, and not really understanding them, but reading them, and I was just drawn to them because in my head I heard the voices. I would act out the parts in my head.
And then after you came to New York to live with your grandmother your senior year of high school, is that right? And then
my senior year in high school, I moved up. Actually, what happened was I got expelled from high school in Florida for being a cut-up. And so it was all part of my master plan to get back to New York. And honestly, it was. My mother actually said, fine, you want it? You want to go? Go. And I was like, yes. And back to grandma's house. And that's when I started auditioning. You know, going, getting backstage and going to open calls and going to readings. I'd go to Naked Angels, I'd go to the Public Theater, I'd go to the Circle Rep and, you know, sit in on workshops, and then I'd get asked to read a part or just read the stage directions, or then I was asked to be a reader for auditions, and then I was cast as an understudy. And so it kind of feels like I went up in the ranks sort of naturally without going to school.
You said you read a lot of plays at the library as a kid. Did you see a theater?
Oh, sure, yeah. And I was in plays. You know, I went to Catholic school, and so I wasn't allowed to do much outside of school and church. And luckily, they intertwined all the things that I kind of enjoyed. There was a theater company, there was a chorus, and I was an altar boy in an incredible monastery that was attached to a rectory. The theater of the church is the most incredible theater. And in this church, it was beyond. It was this huge monastery. It's a landmark. It's a beautiful building. And I kind of had the run of it. And they did like 3 shows a year, and I was in all of them. And my first one, I was like 10 or 11. Didn't matter if there weren't any kids in the show, I was in them. Like, I was in Guys and Dolls playing a gangster, and I was like 12. I was in The Music Man and Flowers for Algernon and Man of La Mancha. And I also had people who, in the theater company, it was always the same people who were also in the choir as well, but they took it very seriously. And so I would have conversations about plays and be turned on to some plays, turn other people on to plays. And then, of course, I would beg my mom to take me into the city to see a play every year. And, you know, I saw Evita. I saw Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, John Turturro. I saw a lot of things.
Looking back at those early days, I mean, you must have thought you were pretty good at this, or you wouldn't have sought it. Looking back on it, do you think you were?
I don't know. I guess, like, you know, when you're young, you know, there's a certain amount of naivete you have, which, you know, I don't knock naivete, to be honest, because I'm 42 years old and I still have, I mean, I've been really had some great experiences. I could tell you way more great than not so great experiences in this business. And I've managed to do what I want to do. So if it's naivete, fine. But I think I've always been optimistic about making a living in this business. You know, I worked in nightclubs for years and I would go and do plays for nothing. You know, I'd go on a call for a showcase off Broadway and get it. So I was getting a lot of parts. So sure, I had confidence that I could do this, but you know, I wasn't starving because I'd do the play and I'd go to work at 11:30 and work till 5 a.m. at a nightclub. And then sleep all day in grandma's house and then come back in and do the play, you know. So I would do whatever I had to do, and it just seemed natural and normal. I never thought, I have to think about doing something else.
And you got a TV role, and that led to a role on a TV show called Third Watch. I confess I'm not familiar with this, but I know you played a paramedic. You were being paid well. I mean, you were now a successful working actor in New York. And I don't know if this is true, but I read
with
that—
With a baby.
With yeah, because so by then you'd had your son, right, Jake, right?
Yeah.
And I'd read that you felt confined, and you asked them to write you out of the role, to have your character killed off. Is this true?
Yeah, it's kind of true. I mean, yes, it's true. But what I went in for was to ask them if my character was going to have anything interesting to do. It is true that I literally went from, you know, having a great night behind the bar, $200, to making television money, and I had never even been on television. You know, I was so happy to get that job that I really wanted to keep the job. And then I just realized that I'd kind of acted myself into a corner. You know, it's a big ensemble. There's like 9 of us. And so everybody has to be a certain thing, you know, on a show like that. And so I really couldn't really grow much. And, you know, a lot of that was my fault. And so when it seemed like I wasn't doing much but smiling a lot and hitting on the same girl for 2 years in a row, I asked them if there would be anything changing. And John Wells was great and kind, and he said, "I don't think so. Do you want to be written out?" And I said, "Sure, I would." And he said, "I will send you out big," which he did. It was a really great story arc to act. And then he took care of me very, very well in many other ways and was just a gentleman about it. And to this day, I appreciate what he did for me, because after that, I really did try to do as many different things as I could. I did Oz right after that. I did Ally McBeal, and then I went and I did The Station Agent, I did Kingpin, and it really opened me up to be able to do many other things.
Well, let's talk about The Station Agent. This was the film in 2003, directed by Tom McCarthy. Got a lot of critical acclaim and a lot of critics' awards. It's about I guess the central character is this man, a solitary train buff who is a dwarf. Right. He's played by Peter Dinklage. He inherits an abandoned train station in a kind of a quiet corner of New Jersey, and he decides to just move into the place. Yeah. And it's this movie about the characters. Patricia Clarkson is an artist who's depressed about the loss of her son. And then you're a guy, Joe Aramis, I think is the name, who has this little vending truck nearby.
A hot dog truck, coffee truck, yeah.
Right, that your dad runs, and he's sick, so you're running it. You love people. You're dying for company. And I want to play a scene here where you're trying to make friends with Finn, played by Peter Dinklage, and he's walking by. You try to engage him. Let's listen.
Hey, Finn. Bro, you live here?
Yes.
Wow, we're neighbors. Nice. Hey, what happened to you?
Nothing.
Listen, you want to go down to the mill and grab a beer later?
No, thanks.
Well, you don't drink?
I do.
Well, you just don't want to have a drink with me?
I don't like bars very much.
Oh. Hey, well, how about I go get a six and we can have it right here?
No, thanks.
Well, what are you going to do?
I'm going for a walk.
Oh, cool. Well, you mind if I come along, man? I need the exercise. I'm turning into a fat out here.
I usually go alone.
Well, I'm a good walker, bro.
Prefer to go alone.
Okay. All right, maybe next time, right? You know where to find me.
And that's our guest, Bobby Cannavale, with Peter Dinklage in the film The Station Agent. You know, one critic said that your character lacked the ability to be rejected.
That's funny. Wow, it was really nice to hear that. You know, that's a really special experience, that movie, because it was, you know, it was so long in the making. Like 4 years, it was 4 or 5 years.
And you and Tom McCarthy, the director and writer, were old friends, right?
Tom McCarthy and I met acting in a play of Lanford Wilson's, a new play of his. We met acting in it about 5 years before we made that movie. And then Tommy wrote a play called The Killing Act, in which Peter Dinklage was in. And then he just started writing this thing for us. And Patty, we knew. And so it was like readings, doing readings. It was always us. It was always Patty and Pete and myself.
Patricia Clarkson, yeah. So you would just get together and he would say, hey, I've written this scene, let's try it.
And I've got some pages and, you know, it wasn't like scene by scene. Like he'd written a draft and then there was another draft and, you know, things changed along the way. And then we'd do like a little public reading just for a few friends that he trusted. And it just was, you know, it's a classic tale of a script going through many options that it could have had. Tommy could have made that movie with other people in it, let's say. But he just didn't want to. He wanted to make it the way he wanted to make it with us. And so we finally got the money. And so when we made it, we always thought it was a good movie, but I never thought it would do what it did. I was just so excited to finally do it. And we made it in 17 days over the summer in New Jersey. Just to give you perspective, the last episode of Boardwalk Empire took 18 days to shoot. So we shot that movie for nothing. And, you know, I'm wearing my own clothes. Not all of them, but some of them. That conversation reminds me of the first conversation I had with Pete. So there are elements of that movie that are very true, have a very true spirit about them.
The film had a great reception at Sundance and really took off. What did it do for your career?
It was really wonderful, and it took us all just by surprise, and it was literally like an overnight type thing. I remember going up to Sundance and Pete and I getting on the bus from our condo to go into town to do something. I think it was maybe just to get like sunglasses or something, just walk around. We'd never been to Sundance before. And we got off, and the first person we saw was Pauly Shore. Who, it was so funny, he was handing out flyers for his movie, and he said, man, everybody's talking about your movie, and it hadn't even premiered yet. And so we went to the screening that night, and it was sold out, packed, and people went crazy, and it was the first time we'd seen the movie. I'd never seen it until Sundance. And everybody wanted to, all these other artists, that's where I met Steve Buscemi, and where I met Stanley Tucci, who are friends today, and guys who I've always admired and respected, and other filmmakers that were up there, like Al Payne and David Russell was up there. And so it sort of offered me an entry into a place that I wanted to be. I did a movie right after that with John Turturro, who was one of my heroes, who loved The Station Agent and cast me in his movie Romance and Cigarettes. And that relationship to this day is a great one. So, you know, and it let me be sort of viable, for lack of a better word, in the indie world, which allows me to be able to stay at home. Like I like to be, because really a lot of my favorite artists are in New York.
Well, I wanted to talk about the recent season of Boardwalk Empire, where you played a New York gangster named Gip Rossetti, right, short for Giuseppe. Mm-hmm. Quite a character. I mean, he had a very prominent role in this season. It will just be this season. Those who've watched it will know. And I thought we would hear a clip. This is a moment where you're meeting with the series' central character, Nucky Thompson, the Atlantic City boss. He's played by Steve Buscemi. And he is angry. Your character, Rossetti, is angry because Nucky Thompson has decided to sell his booze strictly to Arnold Rothstein, the New York gangster, as opposed to directly to your guy. So you, as Gip Rossetti, responded by interrupting his shipments by taking over this little town in New Jersey, Tabor Heights, so that Nucky can't get his booze through to New York. He's pretty annoyed and has come to Tabor Heights, and you're sitting down at a restaurant to try and straighten things out. Let's listen.
Nucky, welcome to Tabor Heights. Police escort and everything.
What do you want, Chip?
I was thinking maybe the pot roast. How about you?
I didn't come up here for your vaudeville routine.
Well, Bible camp ain't till summer. So why did you come?
Obviously, I offended you in some way. But since you're a man who can find an insult in a bouquet of roses, I'm not sure quite how.
Maybe it's got something to do with you jeopardizing my livelihood.
It's a free market. I sell to whom I choose.
To whom? Listen to you.
I wish you'd start.
I got customers. 20 blocks stretch in the Lower West Side. They can't buy from me. They buy someplace else.
I'm not selling to Yale or Remus either. And you don't see them acting like petulant children.
Right. You only sell to the Jew.
I told you. I need to keep things simple.
Like this place. Simple. Only one road in, one road out. Atlantic City to New York.
I'll use the back roads to the Pine Barrens, Chip.
I don't know where the fuck that is. But I bet it's one hell of a slog. And if I was you, every inch of that road would stick in my craw.
But I'm not you, Gip. I learned a long time ago not to take things personally.
Everyone's a person, though, right? So how else could they take it?
In the interest of honoring what was once a fruitful business relationship, let's set the table over again. You'll be my guest in Atlantic City tonight. I'll send you home tomorrow with a full month's supply. You keep your head above water in New York and leave these nice people alone.
Still, I'd help you that way.
What happens after a month?
I don't consider that my problem.
Square enough deal.
Then this is where you shake my hand.
And that's our guest, Bobby Cannavale, with actor Steve Buscemi in the recent season of Boardwalk Empire on HBO. This is such a great character you have here.
Very logical thinker, Gip, right? There's some logic in there. It made sense. He's right.
Right.
What else is it going to be if it's not personal?
Right. Up to a point. But he is also like kind of – well, I don't know if I would say psychotic, but he opens the series. I mean, and I think the first time we see him, he beats a man to death with a tire iron because of some right. casual insult. And right. yet you also make this guy funny and likable. How did you approach building this character?
Well, you know, first of all, I appreciated and understood where it's set, what the milieu is. We're set in the underworld here. And this guy works for the mob, the mafia, at a time when it was a very powerful thing in New York. And so, much like the salesman in Glengarry, you know, he's got to do what he's got to do to stay on top, not just stay relevant. That's the thing about Gip, is he doesn't want to just be relevant. He wants to be remembered, and he wants to be feared. And I would think that in that business, that's a pretty good business to go into if what you want out of life is to be respected and feared. And so I thought of him as somebody who attacks that part of it with relish. Where it comes from psychologically is really well built, I think, in the series as being in the portrayal of him as a person who's far away from home, as a person who always had ambition, as a person who's not respected in his own home, as evidenced in the scene with his family, and who's always felt like he doesn't get the credit he deserves. And so, you know, the killing aside, that kind of a character I is attractive to me because it's somebody who, again, desperately wants something. Then you add the physicality that they've written of him committing murder as much as he does. You know, given the milieu, again, of what the series is about and where it's set, it's very exciting to play a role like that. I've never gotten a chance to play a part like that.
Right. And as the series develops, we learn that your guy has some very kinky sexual preferences. How does that – was there a backstory in his in your head for this guy? I mean, that accounts for something like that?
I mean, I'm always hesitant to talk about exactly what it is because it's not anything that you can really all we have really is the words and the end product, the film itself. And I will just tell you that, I did a lot of research about what that particular sexual picadillo is and what psychologists think it's about. And then I sort of go from there and make up my own thing.
Right. Well, just so we're not coy about it for the audience, I mean, what we're talking about is the fact that he likes to be choked when he's in an intimate relationship with a woman.
Right.
Did that inform your performance in scenes which had nothing to do with sex and, you know, in his confrontations with other people and
sure.
his expressions of violence?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, look, I think Jip's the kind of guy who needs to feel physically stimulated all the time. And so he does that by making a joke that scares somebody that doesn't know it's a joke. He does it by being the loudest person in the room when he wants to be. He does it by cracking jokes in the brothel. He does it by talking seductively to Jillian and in one breath and then laying the hammer down on her in the next. I think for him it's a power issue and a control issue, and I think he gets physical sensation out of that. So that would sort of an indirect lead in to why he enjoys sex that way. I think he gets physical stimulation from murdering people. He does it himself. You know, he's usually the guy doing it. Whatever the psychosis behind that is what I think it is.
Well, whatever it is, it's convincing. I wouldn't want to run into your guy. This is a real period piece. We broadcast out of Philadelphia, which is not far from Atlantic City, so I've been there. And one of the things I like about the show is the careful reconstruction of Atlantic City in the 1920s and everything from the clothes to the boardwalk. Is that something that you connect with?
This show in particular, the production values on the show are unbelievable. And every day felt like I was coming to work in a theme park. Because everything around you, every stitch of clothing I wore was handmade with vintage fabric from the time, and all, every prop is from its time. The lighters that are very difficult to work, and the cars, and they spare no expense. So it's not like you see the same car driving back and forth in the background. There's 30 cars, Packards and Model Ts, and everybody's dressed in the period, and so it definitely makes it a very immersive experience, easier to work when you're surrounded by it all like that. And I think that pops really, really nicely in the final product.
If you're just joining us, our guest is actor Bobby Cannavale. He appeared recently in the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Right now he's on Broadway with Al Pacino in the David Mamet play Glengarry Glen Ross. You've kind of made your own path in the business, and I've read that you still don't have a publicist. Is this true?
Yeah.
So how do you just function on your own? I mean, you have an agent, of course, but...
What do you mean function, though?
I
mean...
I don't know what I mean.
Function, fine. I walked to the studio. I didn't need people, they sent the car, and I just canceled it and walked. You can run your own life. Look, I'm not George Clooney. I'm not like... I don't have... I would think that like a publicist for me wouldn't be to get my name put in places. It would be to like get people to stop bothering me. That'd be a good reason to have a publicist. Do the things that I want to do. Like I wanted to come on Fresh Air. I listen to Fresh Air. I love it. I went on Joe Franklin yesterday because it's Joe Franklin, for God's sakes. He's 92 years old. You know, he wants to have me on the show. I'm going to go. But I know what I want to do and what I don't want to do. And I feel like that about the material that I choose. Now I know I'm lucky, too. I get to choose things. Not as much as some people, and maybe not as much as somebody who wants to be a movie star would think. But in my world, the theater, little projects that I do, workshops, it makes me happy to do the things that I really want to do. And so for me, that's just for me. For my taste, I don't know what a publicist would, where I would put them in my life.
And you don't want to move to Hollywood and become a movie star?
I don't want to move to Hollywood. No, I want to stay in New York.
You know, you've done a lot of television, you've done movies, and a lot of theater. They're obviously different medium. Do you think you're a different actor on stage than you are, say, on a TV set or a movie set?
I guess so. I mean, it's. I don't approach it any different. I just know that, like, for me, the biggest difference between the stage and film and television is that I get to use my whole body, and I really love acting on stage because I can do anything. There's this stillness that isn't required as much as it is on camera. And for me, when I go to the theater, I go to a lot of theater, and I love going to the theater. And when somebody pulls me in and they have a thing that just pulls me in and pulls me into their world, that's why I'm going. And on stage, I feel like I'm more in control of that than I am on film. That's why I really love it so much.
Right, so much is in the hands of the cinematographer and the director on the stage.
Sure.
It's you and the audience.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Bobby Cannavale, good luck with the play, and it'll be fascinating to see where you go next. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Bobby Cannavale spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Cannavale is starring with Al Pacino in the Broadway revival of David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross. Speaking of acting, next week we're going to feature interviews with Ben Affleck and Dustin Hoffman, who have each directed new films. A couple of weeks ago, I saw Dustin Hoffman receive one of this year's Kennedy Center honors on the telecast of the gala. And as part of the tribute, Laura Osnes sang "I've Grown Accustomed to His Face." Coincidentally, I'd just been listening to her over and over on the cast recording of the revival of the little-known Rodgers and Hammerstein musical Pipe Dream. The revival was presented by New York City Encores. I want you to hear a song I especially love from that recording. Here's Laura Osnes singing "Everybody's Got a Home But Me."
Scooted out of Frisco over Route 101, bummed a ride as far as San Jose. Rode aboard a Greyhound till I run out of dough. Landed on my can in Monterey. But I seen a lot of things along the way. And I did a lot of thinking on the way. I rode by a house with the windows lighted up, looking pretty as a Christmas tree. And I said to myself as I rode by myself, everybody's got a home but me. I rode by a house where the moon was on the porch and a girl was on her fella's knee. And I said to myself as I rode by myself, everybody's got a home but me. I am free and I'm happy to be free. To be free in the way I want to be. Won't there ever be a home? house around here?
Top of the hill. You can see it from here.
All I've seen is something looks like a little warehouse.
Oh, that's it. It used to be for storing fish meal. Now I and eight other fellas live there. We call it the Palace Flophouse.
The Palace Flophouse.
It still smells like fish meal a little. But we live there.
Sure. You hardly ever meet somebody who doesn't live somewhere. Well, see ya.
Where are you gonna go?
I don't know.
I guess you'll land on your feet somehow, huh?
I am on my feet. I am free, and I'm happy to be free. To be free in the way I want to be. But once in a while, when I'm talking to myself, and there's no one there to disagree,